In colonial America, terrorist threats often came from the sea in the form of pirate ships flying that Jolly Roger flag. Turns out, their stories are just as interesting as the pirate tales spun by Hollywood movies today. Like women disguised as cabin boys, bored aristocrats out for adventure on the high seas, crews too drunk on rum to fight, and corrupt colonial officials getting in on the game. Today, a visit to the beaches of the Carolina coast can include exploring the legacy of these hard-drinking rogues. Some of their names might live on, say as a brand name on a bottle of rum. The stories of the most intriguing buccaneers are what Terrence Zepke is here to tell us all about. The second edition of her guide to pirate legends, history, and lore is out, and it's called Pirates of the Carolinas. Welcome, Terrence.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Give us some background on this. What was the golden age of piracy in the United States?
Well, we really don't know how long piracy has been around, but it's been around at least 2,500 years there. And there was an era during its heyday that was known as the Golden Age of Piracy. And that was the late 17th century to early 18th centuries. And
I see. So it's before the United States. It'd be colonial America.
It was colonial America when they came over here. And interesting, North Carolina had a lot of the officials had partnerships with the pirates. We were sort of a commerce-poor place back then, so we actually welcomed pirates like Blackbeard until they had the big crackdown on piracy, and that was the end of that.
So is that kind of the fine line between a privateer and a pirate? What's the difference?
It was such a fine line, Rick. Basically, a little piece of paper, because a lot of the pirates started out, they were privateers, and they were involved in Queen Anne's War, wars all over Europe and everything, and they were commissioned to attack enemy ships in order to get money, to get booty to help fund the war. And they split that money with the crown.
So the king or the governor would say, you are licensed to attack ships as long as they're not our ships, and you can keep half the booty, but you got to give the rest to us so we can fight our war or whatever.
Right. And so then imagine when the war is over and your navy is no longer needed like that. Well, this is all these men have ever known. There's no employment. You know, it was a fine line anyway between privateer and pirate, so a lot of them just became officially pirates.
And they got to keep everything.
Yeah.
Nice business model. So now, what was the basic action? It was mostly ships going from Europe to the Americas, or where did they get their best opportunities?
At that time, it was all these merchant ships that were doing these trade routes. And so you could just sort of sit out there. It was just like fishing and just pluck them off. They weren't very well armed or anything. They were slow because they were big, heavy ships with a lot of merchandise on board and all. So, and it really didn't matter. This was one of those falsehoods that people realized. People thought pirates just wanted gold and pieces of eight. But the truth is that they wanted what they could sell. So when they got these merchant ships and they had all these reams of fine linens and silks and tobacco and rum and all, this was pay dirt.
Oh, so they would get this stuff and then they would go to the next port and just, like you see when you travel a lot, people stealing stuff off of ships and setting up a little stand and selling it cheap.
Absolutely. Huh. And that's what they did. And then, like I said, a lot of them were in partnership with the authorities here. And so when they came into port and all that, they would look the other way and then they would get a cut for looking the other way. And the merchants would get discounted goods. The pirates would get money. I mean, everybody was happy.
Sounds like a win-win-win-lose situation. I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're speaking with Terrence Zepke and her book's called Pirates of the Carolinas. We always think Pirates of the Caribbean. And your book is Pirates of the Carolinas. Why was there so much pirate action in the Carolina coast?
Well, at that time, these were pretty poor states, so we needed to get commerce wherever we could. So pirates were good for business. So we sort of were a safe haven for pirates. In fact, Blackbeard, who was one of the probably the biggest chapter discussed in this book, he actually set up shop, actually made a home, and actually came part of the community and all up in North Carolina.
Now, he sounds like an incredible guy, and he's got this treacherous image, but according to your book, he never actually killed anyone because people surrendered when they saw his flag. He was so had such a ferocious image.
I think marketing majors should study Blackbeard because back before that anybody knew what PR, marketing, promotions was, this guy was on top of it. He knew reputation was everything. So he didn't have to do much fighting because his reputation preceded him. So as soon as he ran up his flag, people surrendered because they weren't going to take on the great Blackbeard.
Whoa.
Yeah, he was tall, dark, and handsome. He was like 6'5", and he had pistols and cutlasses and everything draped all over him. And then before he would go into battle, he would light these fuses in his hair. so that when he landed on the ship, there's this smoking huge guy with all these guns hanging off of him, dressed in black with this black beard and everything. So it gave, you know, quite a presence and would give him the element of advantage.
And people would just say, take all my valuables, but just don't kill me. Yeah. And consequently, he never had to kill anybody.
Yeah, well, he did some stuff, too, to help his reputation. He actually took on the Royal Navy one time and defeated them.
Huh.
And pirates tended to stay away from the Royal Navy because they just weren't gonna win when you went up against the Royal Navy.
Yeah.
But Blackbeard did, so that helped fuel his reputation.
He must have been a fun guy to work for, I guess. He's not just a Johnny Depp kind of fantasy, though. He's a real guy. And as a matter of fact, you write about there's a permanent Blackbeard exhibit in the North Carolina Maritime Museum. Tell us about that.
Yeah, in Beaufort, North Carolina, they actually have found what they almost certainly believe, you can't say for certain, but it's pretty certain based on their evidence, that this was the Queen Anne's Revenge, one of Blackbeard's flagships, and it sank off the waters of Beaufort Inlet. And so they've been excavating this ship for many years now, since I think 1996.
Wow.
It's an ongoing process. And so as they get things they bring up from the ship and all, they are cleaning them and preserving them and then putting them on display. At this facility. And it's a great place to learn about the North Carolina coast, about piracy, about maritime history. That's the Maritime Museum in Beaufort, North Carolina.
So if you're interested in, you know, pirate lore, would you say that's the single best place to go for actual artifacts?
I would say so, at least in the Carolinas.
You also talk about pirate tours of Charleston. How's Charleston associated with piracy, and what do you see there?
Oh, Charleston was a big hangout for pirates back in the day. They had lots of places that they liked to come into shore, come into port, and drink and be merry. And actually, also, there were a lot of hangings of pirates that took place in South Carolina as well. And you can actually go on your own or as part of a tour and see White Point Gardens, where some of the pirates were hanged. That was a big thing back in the day, was they actually did public hangings, and it was supposed to discourage piracy. You know, they would leave them up for a long time and put them in these things called gibbets, which were custom-made cages for their bodies and all. So you get a real good history if you do the pirate walk. There's a really good one in Charleston. There's just about every kind of walk and tour option you can imagine in Charleston, including the pirate walk.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking Pirates of the Carolinas with Terrence Zepke. Terrence, I love this. You put a stanza from one of these pirate songs, and it's, I don't have a very good pirate accent, but the words go, "Some fight 'tis for riches, some fight 'tis for fame. This first I despise, and the last is a name. I fight 'tis for vengeance. I love to see flow at the stroke of my saber the life of my foe." That sounds pretty bloody. Is that just sort of a cheerleading song, or was there actually, how bloody were the pirates actually?
Oh, it could get pretty bloody, because you're fighting to the end. You know, once you engage in battle, Blackbeard, when he actually finally reached his end, when the Royal Navy actually finally did beat him, it was considered to be the bloodiest battle in pirate history. And he sustained more than 24 gunshot wounds and cutlass wounds and all that before he was finally beheaded.
Lay the groundwork for the battle. Why and where and what happened?
Up in the Outer Banks. And this is really interesting. Some recent history has revealed that we believe that Blackbeard actually was tipped off, that Lieutenant Maynard with the Royal Navy was hot on his trail, and he had opportunity to get out of there. And he believed that he knew the waters, knew the land, and was a better fighter, and he convinced himself he could defeat the Royal Navy. And it was just, the ship was just covered in blood from, you know, because the men all fought to the end. You know, because they know if the Navy captures you, you're going to be tried and hanged.
Right.
So you've got nothing to lose to fight to the end. And so they were all in with it, you know. And actually, they had told Lieutenant Maynard he needed proof that he actually killed Blackbeard. So he had to behead him and bring the head back to Virginia so that his superiors would believe he did indeed kill the legendary Blackbeard.
And he did that.
Yes, he did that.
And what happened to the head of Blackbeard?
We don't know.
Ooh, there's a ghost story for you. What I found particularly interesting in your book, Pirates of the Carolinas, was the story of women pirates, particularly Anne Bonny, who you said is your favorite pirate. Tell us about her, and why is she your favorite?
Well, because I think in earlier times, if I had had her choices, I would have done exactly what she did. And I have an Irish background. I have wild, long red hair. I was rebellious and everything, so I think I can relate to Anne Bonny. But she was actually from a very affluent family. Her father was a wealthy planter, a businessman, merchant, and everything. At that time, of course, they prearranged marriages so you could marry into another suitable family. And so he had arranged for her to marry this fella who she barely knew, and he was very boring. And she was supposed to, you know, do all the things that women did at that time, where you threw parties and, you know, knitted, that kind of stuff. And Anne Bonny just said, this is not the life I want. And she ran off to sea and became a pirate. So that was kind of a really interesting thing. Now, of course, she couldn't openly be a woman pirate. She had to disguise herself. And it was a very long time before anybody realized that she was actually a woman before that came out. And by that time, she'd proven herself to the crew and nobody gave a problem. But women weren't allowed on the ships back then. So a lot of these women pirates were actually disguised, you know, because there were boys, young men and everything. So it wasn't too hard to disguise themselves on these ships.
Yeah.
You know, they taped their breasts so that they would, you know, and they wore loose clothing, and they weren't showering hygiene things on the ships.
So you couldn't really tell.
They looked a lot like the boys that were there that helped load the cannons and things. These boys, they didn't have any facial hair or anything, so they looked, you know, they could pass.
Tough women. Thinking of Anne Bonny and the gentleman pirates like Stede Bonnet that you write about, it wasn't just looting and plundering. There was more to that among these pirates.
Yeah, they were a brethren. They may have been misfits, outlaws, criminals, whatever, in society, but once they came on the ship and became a part of the crew, they had each other's backs, and, you know, they became much more than pirates. They were living life on their own terms. This was about freedom. Whatever life they would have had on land, they've come out here, and they can work when they work. They can party when they want to party. They can, I mean, they had musicians on board, and, you know, they knew how to live large, and they knew that they probably would die, so they lived as well as they could in what was probably going to be a very short life for them as because of piracy.
So they knew they probably had short lives.
They did, but they lived it hard and fast while they were still here.
Anging from the rigging, singing yo-ho-ho.
And a bottle of rum.
Terrence Zepke, thanks a lot. And we all know a little bit more now about Pirates of the Carolinas. Last week on our show, when we talked with listeners about the kindness of strangers they experienced in their travels, we spoke with a listener aboard his sailboat in the Florida Keys. He was talking about a kindness he experienced from a stranger while on a road trip in Mexico. When we first talked with Jay Bruce, he also mentioned he'd been living for years on his sailboat and exploring the Caribbean and the coasts of the Americas. Not exactly living like a pirate, but we thought you'd enjoy hearing the rest of the conversation we recorded with him right now about what it's like to live full-time at sea. And Jay Bruce is on the line in a sailboat in the Florida Keys. Jay Bruce, thanks for your call.
Yes, thanks, Rick. Thanks for taking my call. I really enjoy your show. I'm now in the Florida Keys for a while, but I've been through all of the Bahamas. I've been the entire Pacific coast of the United States and Central America, through the Panama Canal, the entire east coast of North America, including all the Great Lakes and the Bahamas.
So how long have you been living on your boat?
Since 1988.
Whoa.
So, yes.
Is there a community of people like you that you bump into when you moor at some island in the Caribbean or something? And what kind of a culture is that?
It's fantastic because I actually have friends who I still communicate with, and now that we have the internet, what a wonderful tool. People who I met during my first years out, and I still am in contact with people. And when you pull into a place and you see a boat with a familiar name on it, and that you remember that boat from some place in the world some time ago, it doesn't make any difference when you get there and suddenly you're back to being with your best friends again. It's like your long-lost brothers or something that you find each other. And the people here, even if you don't get along with them personally, whenever somebody needs help, there's always somebody there to help you.
Wow.
And we are all like that. And, you know, truly, we live a very back-to-nature kind of life. I have solar panels and a wind generator that provide me with all the electricity that I need, period. I don't have to hook up to shore power for anything that I have.
Whoa.
And I do catch a lot of my food. And, of course, I buy rice and I buy flour and sugar and salt and things like that. But I do eat a lot of seafood and a lot of vegetables, and I keep a couple of herbs growing on my boat, so I have those. And we're pretty much self-sufficient. So
boy.
I have a water maker, so I can make water if I need to.
I would think there's sort of a do-it-yourself and a communal help everybody out culture when it comes to people living off the land and living off their boats.
Absolutely, absolutely. Anything that I need to have done on my boat, there is someone I know who can do it. And so, you know, if I buy the parts and have them ready, I know that I can find someone who can help me do the job if I can't do it myself. And like I said, even people who you don't really get along with and that you don't choose to socialize with, if they need help, you will be there and help them. And you make friends. You make lifelong friends. And people do this. There are single men and single women out there who are doing this, sailing around the world by themselves. There are families with 2, 3, 4 children who are doing this. They have children born on the boats and continue to raise them all the way through. A lot of them they'll do the homeschool all the way up until high school and then send them to land to do high school. But the children who are raised out there, you'll find that they are such a different type of child because they're not raised with all the conveniences of the United States and not always wanting to play with the Xbox. You know, they're out there swimming with nature and learning about that. And, you know, it's just a wonderful community. And all the kids seem to be genuinely nice kids. It's wonderful. And a lot of times, too, you can actually get some of the small ones. When I say small, maybe like 12, 13-year-olds, they can crawl up to places that
they can go get the barnacles off your hull.
Can't do any longer.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Hey, when you read in the newspaper about these pirates and people like you who all of a sudden get taken over by pirates, are they just foolhardy and going to the wrong places, or can that surprise you around the corner anywhere?
It can surprise you, but on the other hand, there are places that we know of to stay away from. Like, for example, when you want to go from Australia up to Indonesia, you know that you're going to go at a certain time of the year because of the way that the winds blow. And so all of the sailors who are going to do that crossing, they gather and they'll do it all as a group. And that way you feel a little more protected. Of course, right now, Somalia, we know that it's a bad area. But again, it's the only way to get to the Suez Canal if you want to go up into the Mediterranean without going around Africa. So you've got a choice to make.
And the pirates know that, so you have to.
And the pirates know that, of course. Mm-hmm. Now, it's still rare for them to really take a small sailboat because there's not that much they can do with it. It's not as valuable. You know, they're hoping for the hostage situation that the U.S. government is going to come in and do something with that respect. So,
any regrets over the last 20 years of living on your boat?
Not a single one.
Life is going to go by one way or another. You might as well do it eating the wind and exploring the world and making all those friends.
Absolutely. Right now what I do is actually I work with a young people's group that we take them out sailing here in the Florida Keys, and we teach them about the reefs that are here, teach them how to sail, teach them a little bit about fishing. It's not primarily a fishing trip, but mainly it's to teach them about our ecosystem down here.
Nice.
And we'll get 1,200 people a week that come through our program.
Poor.
And so it's a wonderful program.
You're not contributing very much to the economy, but it sounds like you're having a very fulfilling life. I think this is an inspiration. Thank you so much, and happy sailing. All right.
Well, thank you very, very much. I really appreciate your show. I listen to it every time I'm within range of NPR.
So. All right. Good man. Thanks
great.
A lot.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye now.
Bye-bye.
I'm going to get you on a slow boat to China.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Europe Through the Back Door in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton with Sarah McCormick. You'll find links to our guests and archives of each week's show in the radio section of ricksteves.com. Thanks for studio help to our colleagues at WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and for website help to Andrew Wakeling and Kate Melhern Graham. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. We'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Arr.